Welcome to The Storyfield. This is a podcast created and sponsored by the Allen Firm. This is Josh Allen, and I'm joined by Micah Petrie. I think you'll agree that life is complex, business is hard, and living a life of faith can feel complicated. We know it's discouraging when movement in your life or business or faith has stopped. Well, you're in the right place to hear some great stories of normal people just like us who will inspire you to move forward in life. So thank you for joining us today. We know you're going to be encouraged. So welcome to The Storyfield. We are extremely honored to have Kevin Cobb on the show today. So Kevin, hey man, thanks for making time for this interview.
Absolutely. Glad to help. And as you'll see, I've got some unique stories. God's led me down some crazy paths, and I'm excited to share with you guys.
Well, that's what we're going to find out about. So just a few kind of big highlights, and we're going to dive into it. So Kevin, you're a Stephenville High School grad, and then you went on to play college football as a quarterback for Houston Cougars, and that was under Art Briles. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then in 2007, you were drafted in the second round of the NFL and played 4 years with the Eagles, 2 years with the Cardinals, and then on to 1 year with Buffalo. And then I know you're an entrepreneur by heart. So upon your retirement from the NFL, you were involved in founding and operating multiple businesses and just still continue that today. And I guess the rest of your time, you're probably focused on your large family and hunting and fishing. So you have our heart on that as well. So thank you for making time today.
You bet. Yeah, you nailed it. That's pretty much the long and short of the last 15 to 20 years. And okay. There's, of course, a lot more details in there than that.
Well, that's what I want to find out. So back up. So kind of start us at childhood. Like where were you? You weren't born in Stephenville. You were raised here. So kind of start us at the beginning.
So I was born in Victoria down in South Texas. My family's from the Corpus Christi area. My parents, my dad was a Navy brat and moved all over the place, settled in there. And I always say he must have been a really bad coach because we moved like 11 times throughout my childhood. I think 7 different towns, something like that. But we ended up in Decatur, which is in North Texas. And that's where I would consider that I was raised. I was there for almost 8 years. And then going into my ninth grade year, my sister's 4 years older than me. Going into my ninth grade year, that was where we said we would make a switch if we ever got the opportunity. And we saw what Stephenville was doing. My dad wanted to coach under Art. And of course, I wanted to play under him. And it's a great community. So we made the move. That would have been, I guess, in 1999.
Oh, so that was your freshman year, essentially?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Did your dad coach on the staff? I mean,
he did. He coached for 2 or 3 years because then as I started to elevate my play, he wanted to get a chance. He was actually out recruiting and doing other things and working his tail off. And so he didn't have the opportunity to watch me as much. And so he started a little business and then was able to be at more games and watch me.
Okay. Now, were you just kind of a natural? Like, tell us kind of how you got into football and even quarterbacking. I mean,
I was a big kid. I'll be honest with you. I was a fat little punk. My mom fed me, she fed me blueberry muffins for snacks. I mean, I go back and look at the calorie count she was feeding every day. I'm like, Mom, what? I mean, she put me.
She had a plan for you.
She was thinking lineman. So. Yeah, she was thinking lineman.
So the really cool thing is my dad's 5'10", my mom's 5'6", maybe 5'6". There's nobody tall in my family. I'm 6'3", 230, and it really is a God story. I'm not just saying that. I don't have a clue how I got here this size. And my dad was a really good talent. He was a college basketball player who didn't even pick up basketball until he was probably a freshman in high school. I don't have his ability. I was born with eye hand coordination, and then being a ball boy my entire life, being around those guys throwing, you know, you've seen coaches' kid stuff, and that's really where it evolved. And so I just knew what everybody was thinking and what the coaches were thinking, and just became a gym rat basically.
Yeah, I mean, you were always on the field. You're always around it. I mean, just the whole time, your whole life, essentially.
Exactly.
So when you came to high school, ninth grade, was that as it started, or did you catch Stephenville at the beginning of it? I mean, your whole ninth grade year, the whole high school experience.
Yeah, the ninth grade year we were coming off the defending state champs in 1998. A lot of expectation, and actually, they asked to bump me up, and I said, no, I wanted to play with the freshman team because obviously those were the guys that I was going to be growing up with, you know, and I didn't want to come in and then think I was anything different than them. So I play on the fresh team, but then I got bumped all the way to varsity for the playoffs and was the backup quarterback and actually played in three games on our state run, which was, yeah, I wanted to vomit because I was just a little young pup, you know. And believe it or not, my first play, we went to the house. We scored a touchdown on my first play and in Shotwell Stadium. So we won state championship. And then I said I didn't deserve a ring, so I didn't get a ring. And I never got back to it. So I wish I would have got the ring freshman year when they offered it to me.
Yeah, I mean, you were 14 at the time and like playing with the varsity in the playoffs. Wow. Yep. Yeah, that has to be one of those stake in the ground type of moments. So what was it?
It was just to come from Decatur and then come here, and you know, you guys remember, you've heard about it. 20,000 people in the stands. I mean, rocking. It's legit high school, Texas high school football back then. It's not quite the same now, but we've got some guys that are getting it there again.
Yeah. So you spent the next 3 years until you graduated playing under Art. So I've heard a lot of just great things about that guy as a coach and a man. So what was his secret sauce? Like, why does everybody love him as a coach so much? Like, how was he so successful?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. It's a lot like the story of Jesus. He just humbled himself and he made us feel like he was our best friend. I mean, gosh, this guy would run and lift and catch routes. And he was, to us, he was kind of, you know, I don't mean this, but he was a football god, you know, and here this guy's being goofy and cutting up with us. And I just remember made me feel like coaches. He has creative ideas to get you motivated. Well, I could give you 1,000 stories, but I mean, I just remember thinking back going, man, I believed everything he said. And you know what's unique about it? I know he believed everything he said. So of course we believe it as his followers, you know? And so I think anytime a leader really firmly believes and gives it good, you know, prayer and thought and what he's putting into these kids and or employees, then I think those people will follow you because they can see that off this, you know, that authenticness around about you.
So he must have done just a lot of, was he always casting vision as far as like we're going to win? I mean, that type of stuff too, playoffs, state, or it was just more about you. Like, I see this in you. I see this in you. I see this in you.
You know, that's an interesting question. I would say we didn't make it our goal. Like, we knew the state championships were our goal, but we didn't sit there and say we're winning district. If we win this game, we win district. We didn't say stuff like that. We were so focused on the details, and he would just teach us, hey, it's all about repetition. Hey, it's all about how hard you push through this rep. And but again, he's doing it way harder than what we could ever dream of. And so I think probably the combination of casting out vision, but not making, you know, it's kind of, you know, this in business, sometimes dreamers get their butts kicked. Mm-hmm. You know, I always tell guys, young guys come to me, I said, quit being a dreamer, just go to work every day. And then, but, you know, keep your vision out there, but don't dream every minute of the day. You'll forget that you got a job to do, you know, and he was pretty good about that.
That's interesting. I appreciate you sharing about him because
I was going to say, so you weren't even, after high school, you went to U of H. But if I remember correctly, I think you were signed to go somewhere else until U of H said, hey, we're bringing in Art.
Right.
I'm guessing that connection was so tight that you were like, all right, well, I'm just going to go ahead and follow that guy.
You know what? It's really unique. So he was at Texas Tech. So after we won the state championship my freshman year, he left. But all the coaches stayed. And we had all the same staff. And it's the staff that went to Houston, ended up going to Houston. So I committed to Oklahoma State at the end of my junior year and loved Stillwater, mini Stephenville, that whole deal. Was really excited about where the program was going at that point and did. And then he got the job at Houston. And I know that everybody thought that's what I was going to do, but I was really heartbroken because I really liked Stillwater. And so we go down there and I remember on the drive and I get a call and I get a text. Hey, you're taking so-and-so. So now there's like six coaches that I've played for that are all going to go to Houston. Then I hear that Sterling Doty's transferring from Army and so-and-so's transferring from Tech. And now there are six or seven players that are coming to Houston. So I felt some pressure to go. And I'm not going to lie to y'all. I got down there and, you know, some of these inner city ladies start screaming at me and you park too close to me. And, you know, I mean, you felt like you had to have a gun. It's a gun carrying around, you know, to protect yourself. And I wasn't quite sure it was for me, but probably answer your next question. What actually tilted it, what swayed it was I had a friend's dad come over to me and say, "Hey, I know you love Stillwater, but you're not going to make it in the NFL." And I was like, "Yeah, I know. I'm not trying to play in the NFL." And he goes, "More than likely, you're going to be a businessman, and Houston has a lot more opportunity for you than Stillwater, Oklahoma. So keep that in mind." And I literally remember my pros and cons list, and that was the last one. It was 13-12 in favor of Houston because of that.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I mean, even kind of looking back over the last years for you, but that's a hard thing for him to say. I know you didn't want to go to, maybe you said you didn't want to go to the NFL or that wasn't really on your chart, but and that's a little bit of a tough thing to hear too. Maybe it's always in the back of your mind.
It, you know what? It really wasn't. I didn't think I was good enough. You know, I wasn't highly recruited. I had 6 or 7 offers, good schools. I mean, some really nice schools offered me, you know, TCU and Tech and Oklahoma State, Purdue, obviously Houston, but I wasn't somebody who, you know, had a box full of them. So yeah,
your focus is on just getting around.
Yeah. My parents were coaches and teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't have any money, you know? So yeah. They were just like, "Hey son, well, don't be thinking too big yet."
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So 4 years down there, you played, did you play 4 years or was it longer or shorter?
I played all 4 years. I started as a freshman.
Yeah. What was that experience like? I mean, so obviously, I mean, Mike and I, we don't have any real, you know, that type of experience in college. I mean, we're not athletes. So it's just like, I mean, you know,
right.
So what is it like to be a college athlete? I mean, to me, it seems just extremely difficult. Like 2 full-time jobs, but.
It is. I don't even know what it'd be like to be a college student. So I can't even speak, you know, I mean, obviously I was a student, but you're a student athlete. Mm-hmm. And, I think back and I think, man, we had no time. I mean, seriously, just from 5:30 to 9:30 at night, you just were going all the time. Luckily, school was pretty easy for me, you know, and we had some really good professors that helped in some areas. But I don't think you do any better. I think you were naive to it. We started off like 6-1 or 7-1 that first year, and our only loss was to Michigan at Michigan, and they were number 2. And we actually, the score doesn't resemble that, but I ended up having an incredible year. And I looked up and had no idea what I was doing. I just had my head focused, and I think I threw 36 touchdowns. And then here's a great story. I'm sitting there, and one of the guys in our conference, I forget his name slipped me right now, but he was at Tulane, and he gets drafted like 22nd overall to the Buffalo Bills. And I was picked above him in conference in the coaches poll, and it's like ding. And I was like, I remember I was calling my sister, and I said, "Amy, I think I might be able to play in the NFL." And she's like, "Shut up, you can't play in the NFL." No, seriously, this guy just got drafted in the first round. And you know what the best thing was, guys? I remember sitting down that night, and I couldn't help myself. I started looking at ranches.
So you were after you heard that. You're like, okay, I'm going to go and start finding my ranch.
Go find my ranch, just like a young kid. Yep, already trying to spend it.
You're a real Texas man, though.
Absolutely. Yep. So
what was, as far as just like the college football experience, was there a favorite place to play? I mean, besides home, was there one of the coolest kind of experiences? Like, man, you loved playing here, or is it just a cool experience because it was so hard to play there?
You know, What's ironic is home was not where we wanted to play, because home, you know, we were at that point, we would attract 12,000-13,000 people. I was playing in front of less people there than what I was at Stephenville.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there was times they said they were going to shut the program down because we couldn't get enough people out there. And I mean, there was some incredible pressure we were feeling as student athletes. And so we went 3 and we won the conference for the first time since Andre Ware or whatever. And the conference championship was at Houston, and they sold out the stadium. We won 5 in a row and came back home after a long road trip. And literally there's 13,000 people in the stands, and it's crickets. And we were just blown away that this even existed, you know? So I think that'd be the proudest moment for everybody that was involved through those 4 years was, and I know that sounds cliche, like you said, other stadiums, but literally our stadium was one that we were not fired up to play in most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Well, so how does the drafts work? So what happens? How do you even get on the radar? Are they already looking? Like, just act as if we do not know, because we don't. So,
okay. All right. So, well, obviously there's people throughout the year that come and visit. Scouts are in and out all the time. So you're kind of getting a baseline for, is there interest in you? And then you go through this, at a certain time, agents have to request meetings and they have to go through the school for you. So you're literally right there where you're doing study hall and you're meeting agents in there. And you kind of go through this process of trying to pick, you know, get that narrowed down to one or two. I would say that's the most important thing for a student, for an athlete that's going to go into, you know, professional sports, is you've got to pick the right agent. And so I picked a group called Select Sports Group out of Houston. They had Cliff Kingsbury, Wes Welker, actually ended up representing Art later on. They got Case Keenum, just to kind of forget. Well, there's some other bigger names now, but, you know, anyways, the kind of guys that I thought that would be my friends if I was around them, you know, and they were all satisfied with them. So you pick them. And then I actually didn't graduate, because this is February of my fourth season. See, I didn't redshirt. So I still like 18 hours to graduate. And my mom's so mad at me that I'm never going back and finish, but whatever. Guess I could have done that for Mother's Day. I could have surprised her. But so then you get invited to the Senior Bowl. You hope to go to a bowl game, one of these bowl games. And I got invited to the Senior Bowl. That's the best one to go to. And you go size up against these other guys. And then, of course, you get invited to the combine. And at this point, you kind of know where you're going to be. So they had me pegged as a fifth or sixth rounder, which doesn't mean anything. And then I started to climb the charts. A lot of that came from just one-on-one time with these guys. And then they bring you in, they start doing one-on-one workouts. So then you take these trips. And there was a lot of talk about the Houston Texans. I mean, they told me straight up they're going to draft me in the second round. And I just started to accelerate up the charts, and we knew it was going to be we thought we might be able to go in the bottom of the first, but I was thinking it'd be the top of the third is where I expected to go.
Hmm. And then,
of course, went to Philadelphia at 36.
Yeah. Was that exciting? I mean, the news going up there, or was that a little bit of a shock factor on like, man, I didn't really see that one coming?
You know what? We filled out this little chart. My whole family, there was like 30 of us there, and I'm the only one that put Philly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it when I was there. I could tell by the way they were treating me. And you know, Andy's pretty coy. He did some sly things to make sure that I didn't jump too high for him, you know, but I could just tell there was some sort of connection between us. I was not excited about going to Philadelphia whatsoever. Still am not. I mean, I don't care if that gets publicized or not. It was just a different place for me. And thankfully I'd been at Houston for a while, so I was used to the big city at this point, but Philly's still another animal.
Yeah. So you get drafted. What's the next, like what happens? Like practically,
so I get married first. So I get married I got married in February, and then that's April 29th, I think, is when we had it that year, April 28th, something like that. And I get drafted high enough because they had traded back, so I'm the number one pick for this draft class. I get the number one jersey and everything, you know. I'm sitting at my pawpaw's farm in South Texas and thinking I'll just show up to minicamp in a week, you know, and rookie minicamp. And no, they call me and they're like, hey, you need to be here in the morning. And I'm like, what? it's like 7:30. And Whitney gets, that's my wife, Whitney. She gets on the phone and she calls JC Penney's in San Antonio. And how long are y'all open? We have to haul butt over there and get a suit that's about four sizes too big. It's the only one on the rack. And then I fly out at 5:15 the next morning with her, and we have to go do the Philly cheesesteak cooking. I mean, it's just a big, you know, road show at that point. And you're exhausted. You're confused. They put us in this little dumpy motel, believe it or not. And I think the guy got shot outside of our door.
Oh, seriously. Man.
Yeah. It was a mess.
That's how you know you're the number one pick in Philly.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a residence inn, and I know it's at some point when we were there, somebody got shot outside of our door.
Oh, you're like, yeah. You signed on the dotted line. So
yep. And the funny thing is, me and my wife were sleeping in a bed, and right next to us was, I forget his name. He's going to be so mad if he ever heard that I forgot his name. He was a wide receiver from Mississippi, and he's sleeping in the bed next to us, and we're just, hey, man, good morning. He's like, hey. Crazy, man.
Yeah. So you don't even get your own room. You have to share it with somebody else.
Had to share a room, yep.
We're like, we're professionals now. Yeah.
A lot of guys go through that. You know, you can imagine coming from like a Clemson. I've been to Jaguars facility. They were very interested in me. It may be better now, but I forget the number one picks, but coming from Clemson and all the money that's provided to that football program, and then I'm telling you, there's rats running around in Jaguars locker room. Yeah. So he probably got big shock this last week.
Man, that's interesting. So then do you start your training really soon after that? After you kind of did the road show? I mean, pretty soon thereafter that you start training, y'all moved.
Yeah, you go straight to rookie mini camp. So, like, they're in it right now. They're getting rookie mini camps right now. And that is a whirlwind, man. They give you a book that's this thick and say, learn it, you know. And that's whenever it gets real. I mean, you've got to buckle down and keep your job because there's nobody above getting cut in the NFL. And it gets, yeah, you get treated like, you know, you're in the infantry of the Army pretty much.
You know that going in, right? Like, they tell you, like, man, you're replaceable. We're not, you know, you're not, the world doesn't revolve around you. That type of, I mean, you just know that going in
pretty much. I mean, they try to court you a little bit in the beginning, you know, to make sure that you, that you'll actually accept their offer and you can, you know, you'll come, which of course 98% of people do. You don't have the leverage to do anything different. And then when you get there, it's like, oh, that's not the same guy that I met when I was on my trip, you know? But you've heard who, you know, kind of the attitudes and the stories that come along with these coaching staff sometimes. But I was with Andy's staff. I mean, they were awesome. Andy was really hard on me, but I didn't bother me at all. I was coach's kid. I was used to getting yelled at.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to, what is the speed difference? Cause I played in high school, but I can only imagine that's like a Pinto. And then you roll up into D1 football. And let's say that's like a souped up Mustang. And then you get to the NFL, it's got to be like a Lamborghini or Ferrari something as far as the speed.
Yeah, so here's the interesting thing. I think going from freshman football, that time they moved me up to in the playoffs, I thought that was the biggest jump I ever made. I was a big kid. And so a 6'2", 210-pound defensive end gave me more trouble than what maybe the pros did because as it got bigger, I was already bigger, you know, and so it just the game actually – slowed down some to me. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, it was flying at the NFL level. I think the thing that people don't realize is it's very cerebral. That's the difference between D1 and the pros. I mean, everybody out there, their eyeball, I mean, you're doing this the whole time before you take the snap. You don't even know what your snap count is because you're going, well, he looks like he knows exactly where I'm going with the ball. God, how does he know that? And then, you know, that linebacker looks like he's going to – I mean, they're playing games with you. And – they can. When we had a really good defense when we were there, we were, you know, Brian Dawkins, Javon Kearse, Sheldon Brown, Lito Shepard, those guys are all Pro Bowlers, you know, and that's who I had to go against every day. Right. Brutal.
Yeah, I've heard that like at some point it slows down, it doesn't really seem like it's that fast because you're just so, I guess, you just adapt to it, or your brain just works so much faster to pick up stuff that it doesn't seem physically fast. So yeah, that makes total sense.
It's still like that to this day. I don't have it near as much, but there's a scenario. Me and my wife were driving in a car, hit the ditch and popped back out, and I fishtailed my car and the guy's grill guard hit the side of my truck and she's like, how did you miss that? How did you even see that coming? And to me it was just, and this is right in the heart of my NFL career, it was super slow-mo. And I was like, hey, did you see that move I just put on that car? That's what I told her right after the accident. And we got out, guys, and there's a pinstripe of paint off the side of my truck where I fishtailed around, and the guy's grill guard was coming like this, and he barely caught the paint, scratched the paint off the side of my truck for about 6 feet. And I was like, yeah, that's what, you know,
that's a good move.
I was pumped up.
Nailed it.
We're like, oh, let's go check on the guy. Let's go make sure he's okay, you know.
That's funny.
But it was amazing some of the things that my mind was geared to, you know, nothing got me rattled, and you could see it coming from a mile away. It's really, you know, bizarre, but 20,000-30,000 hours of training will do that to a person.
Right. And this is my last NFL question.
Okay.
Who hit you the hardest?
The worst hit I ever had was Brian Arakpo at Washington.
Oh my gosh.
It was a terrible play call. I knew it when they installed the play on Tuesday, on Wednesday, and we had this second year tight end. We expect them to block a Brian Arakpo, and I'm supposed to, if I see the corner do this, I'm going to pump him and hold on to the ball. And I end up throwing a touchdown, but my helmet popped up about, if I remember correctly, it popped up about 4 foot in the air, and I had long hair at that time. My hair was going everywhere, and I jumped up and started talking trash to him. And I got lightheaded and about fell over, and then everybody grabbed me, you know.
Right.
I was a meathead, man. That's why I didn't last very long. I still played like I could run around and hit people.
Yeah, I want to just kind of like, we'll hit a few more of these and we'll move on too, because I know, I mean, there's so much more of the story. But what were there some just like clear, these are the coolest experiences I've had just while you're playing?
No. No, not until you're done. When you get done, you go, wow, God showed up incredibly. Look at how in the world did that timing happen? You know, and what's so cool is I had specific desires and prayers that I was praying at this time. And I had drifted from my faith a little bit at this point. I got caught up in the fame and the faith and the bull crap that is, it's a very dark world in the NFL. Everybody, the louder you scream, the more money you make, you know, I drove a $22,000 truck, so I didn't go that off the financial deep end, but I went off some of the other roller coasters, you know, and it's just the biggest feeding of the flesh you could ever imagine, you know, and it's more like the more flamboyant you are about it, then if as long as you play good, then you're going to get even more. And my spirit was never comfortable during that whole time. I felt like I was on a different planet and I didn't belong here. I just felt lost, you know, and I don't mean lost like I didn't know that what I was doing. I mean lost like, why is everybody faking it? This is not what I'm not designed to do this. You know, I just want to go home and I want to get back to clean living like I was raised, you know, doing. And so I was thrilled when I got hurt and it was over. I really was. I was ready to come home.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about your spiritual life and journey then, kind of, you know, in that. And I want to find out about the retirement, but
yeah. So when I moved to Stephenville, we were raised Catholic. My mom was a staunch Catholic, and we got to Stephenville, and you know, she just said, hey, I want to, she was a spiritual leader in our house. My dad, he's a Christian, but he just wasn't a vocal spiritual leader that we're called to be. And so my mom took some steps just to get us, just to grow a relationship with Jesus. And we found a church, and I got saved at 16. And then through college started to slowly drift. I mean, I'd come and go, I guess, you know, I felt like I hate to even say this, but sometimes typical college stuff, you know, you got to go through this maturation process. And I wasn't very rooted. I don't know that I was discipled enough at that those 3 years I was in high school. Fast forward pros, my wife and I are both Christians. I'm supposed to be leading her. And man, looking back, I was just a horrible leader. I had three children while I was in the NFL, all three girls, all three in different states. And when I got home, this is where the story takes a turn. So I'm the starter in Buffalo. And you know how the last preseason game, you have the one series that you take that they let the starters play, that one series before you start the regular season. And I'm driving the team down the field, and we actually scored, and I dive for a first down. I look up to see if I get the first down or not. And a guy kicks me in the back of the head on accident and just slingshots me. And I go numb from the waist down. I'm blacked out. I pop up, and I'd already told my wife at this point. And anyways, I finished the drive, believe it or not, and we score. And I come to the sideline, and one of my best coaches said, hey, I saw that. And he knew if I got one more, because I had 4-19 games at this point, my last 19 starts. And I'd already told him, if that happens, I'm done. There's there's no excuses. I'm out. And he said, is this it? And he's a rookie offensive coordinator. This is his first offense. And he's just, you know, he's like trying to do right by me, which is funny because I get asked to be in all these concussion lawsuits all the time. I'm like, no, nobody mistreated me, man. Everybody looked out for me. Like, y'all are crazy. Y'all are all after a money grab. You know, I'm not doing that. So this guy's sitting there, just, he knows his career's on the line. And he's sitting there staring at me. And I said, you got to give me 5 minutes because my adrenaline has to come down. And if my adrenaline comes down, I'll be able to tell you I've been through enough to know. In 2 minutes, I couldn't make out a face in the whole stadium.
Mm.
Yeah, it was wild. And I said, And so they had to escort me in the locker room. And my wife and I stayed for about 3 weeks and let the kids get to through their little Halloween with their school. And then we pie-yied back.
Really?
And at this point, I did have a ranch. And here's where God's divine intervention happens. My mom told me later on that when I was an 8-year-old, I told her I was going to own a 2,500-acre ranch in Texas. And she said, you know, yeah, you're crazy. How in the heck do you think that's going to happen? And come to find out, the first one I ever bought was 2,441 acres. And I didn't know that the two stories were consistent until after the fact. So my wife and I, this has been my dream, right? I'm going out there, and if I showed Joe where this place is, you literally can't see a light. You can't see it. You don't even, you struggle to find a person for 3 days. And we'd already built the house out there. It's a beautiful place on the river. And my wife and I go straight there. We stay there for 3 months and do everything that I think that the whole world's supposed to, like, this is going to be it. You know, I'm in. And I made it. I made more money than I thought I was going to make. This is the whole story. This is going to be awesome.
But how old were you at this? How old were you at this time, Kevin?
Good question. 29.
Okay.
29. And I was trying to think if I had my fourth child by then. I don't think that I had. I haven't. I had not. So we spend every day hunting, fishing, cooking, you know, just good family fun. And my wife just sits back and she lets me make, you know, have my time. And it was like 2 weeks before we were supposed to leave. And I told her, I said, hey, let's go back home. Let's go back. We have a lake house on Lake Granbury. I said, let's go back home. I'm ready to go home. And she was like, what? And she could tell something was wrong. And so the next day it was raining. We pack up the kids and we start heading home and everybody's camped out in the back seat and asleep. And she's asleep also. And she wakes up and she looks at me and I'm sitting there bawling and she's like, what's wrong with you? And I said, I'm 29 years old and I beat every goal I ever had. And I said, that was heaven.
Mm.
That was my heaven. And I was like, that ain't it. I said, the good thing is I know what's it, but I want you to come with me and I'm going to figure this Jesus thing out. Like, I'm going all in and we're never turning back. And, yeah, so that was in 2013, and I got baptized. I'd never been baptized after I got saved, so I got baptized in the lake about 6 weeks later, and wow. I got to lean on some men that didn't even know. They had seen me partying and seen me have all these, you know, fancy boats, and I mean, guys, I had an airplane, 6 houses, and boats. I mean, I had a lot of stuff, ranches, and that was the turning point in our family for sure. And so my kids don't even remember those days, you know. They were just little toddlers, but now they get to see what a real man's supposed to lead like.
What grace of the Lord to, and how interesting is that? Like, I mean, everybody hears that, you know, everybody's like, yeah, if I had all this stuff and all that, then I'd be happy. You know, that's the old deal, but what grace that God had on you to be like, not let that fulfill you in enough way to push him to you. And now you get to enjoy it through him in the right way.
And that's so true. I think about it all the time. I love telling the story because it takes me back to that place, you know, of the coolest thing to me was my point of surrender was at the top. And, you know, God will meet you wherever you're at in your story, wherever you need to be for surrender. And it was in my biggest level of comfort. It was in my, you know, my biggest level of pride, probably. Hey, look at all I've built here, you know. And that was just as lonely as it is if I'm sitting down there broke as a joke and would have lost it all. You know, there's no question, but God knew that's where he had to meet me. And that's, and he waited on my timing. He, you know, he's a God that wait, you know, he's arms wide open, but I always say he's not, you're not dragging him around. He's not holding onto your foot and you're dragging him through life. You know, you just got to repent and turn around. And that's, thankfully at that moment, that's what I did.
Yeah. I've had a mentor for a long time. This elder gentleman was so great. He always said, God's a gentleman.
He's not gonna
violate, you know, what you want. You can have as much of him as you want, though.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So from there, so you were 29. From there, I know entrepreneurship is was that even your degree? Maybe even, or didn't you have I mean, that's what you're working toward. That's in your heart, anyways, the whole time. So.
Correct.
What's the next leg of the journey? Did you just start forming companies and businesses and, you know, what'd you do?
Actually, my first year in Arizona, I'd made a pretty good chunk of change at this point. I started putting out feelers into some, you know, some guys that were being successful that I'd gone to college with. And at this point, oil and gas, Barnett Shell's done its thing. Eagle Ford's kicking off. Permian's getting some smoke out there. And quite honestly, every young guy I knew was making a lot of money. It was a go-getter. And so I was ready to build something outside the game of football. So I didn't have to look back and say, God, they're going to pay me X to do this. You know, I got to stay. I felt trapped. I wanted to make enough something outside to get me out of there. And so we started this business in a frack water transfer in 2011. That thing was kicking off pretty good in 2013. So I felt like I had a successful business to come back home to, but it wasn't built on me. So I didn't have to go to work every day, which was a beauty. Being an absentee owner can teach you some of the best traits about being a really good CEO than you can ever imagine. And then when I got back is when I kind of started my real estate routine and I grew into something. And what I learned during that time was I lost on two deals where I was just an LP basically. And of course you heard my spiritual story and I just told myself, you know what? I'm going to start betting on people. I got to have some parameters and I wasn't sure what they were, but I just knew that if I bet on people that we were going to do something good with it, you know, over time. And cause people are the reason I lost the first two. And so I put together this little trifecta that I stick with and I still stick with it today is number one, it's the person. I got to find that right person. Doesn't have to be the most sophisticated in that field, but he has to have the drive and the desire. And of course, he's got to have a heart for God because I don't want to be looking over his shoulder, wondering if he's stealing from me or, you know, I want him to, I always tell him, I said, I want you to be sitting on the couch resting with your kids, but that means you're running a well-oiled machine. You know, the second one was I had to choose. And I learned this in the first couple of small deals I did, but it had to be the right industry. And I know that sounds vague and simple, but meaning I didn't want to go spend 280 days a year. Nothing against people that do this, but in a business that could on its high end could do 275,000, you know, or even 750,000. I looked at all these industries and I said, okay, over the last 120 years, let's look at where the wealth in this world has come from. And it narrows down to about five or six different silos, you know. And so then I thought, well, who do I know in these silos? And then how's, and then are they strategic to where I live and all these different things? So that's kind of how I put my plan together. And then the third one was timing. You know, I knew I didn't want to get any deeper in oil and gas, even though that was the sexy thing to do at that time, because my gosh, it was $140 oil. You couldn't get into anything. Everything was expensive. That's when I shifted and started to come to real estate and started having some success here. And then realized that was really my business calling, if you will. This is where I have the most fun.
Yeah. And really your desire, even when you're eight, like exactly. I love that part of your story. So when you say timing, do you mean just, you're kind of looking at like, I mean, take the oil and gas industry, for example, you're just like, man, it's been good for whatever. The timing's not good going forward. Like who knows what it's going to do like that type of timing.
Yes, like the cycles of those larger industries, right? And I never want to get into anything. It doesn't have to be the bottom. I don't try to time out those perfect swings, but it scares me to death for my own friends how many people are coming into real estate right now, you know, and especially at an agent level, or they've had a really good career and they're making 105,000 or 85,000, but they see their buddy making 600 grand over here and he's flipping stuff and they give it all up and here they come. And the worst thing that can happen to you, man, is you have some success and then the market changes, because now you're out there with some giant risk that you weren't willing to take when you first came in. And I didn't want to be put in that position. I wanted to be in a position where I knew I was buying equity from the word go.
Yeah. Man, I like the way you think through just the trifecta, and that's wise. And I know personally a couple of your person people picks. So, man, right. You've done really well with that in the industry and timing. So that's, man, I appreciate you sharing that.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about we were talking a little bit beforehand just about the first priority of America, because I was just kind of asking you, because I've seen you speak at, you're very generous with your time as far as speaking at various, you know, FCAs and groups and luncheons and, you know, those type of deals. But tell me, I've never heard about this first priority of America. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it all started with, we're all wondering, are we doing enough in the ministry, you know? And when I first came back, the biggest thing was people have to see a difference in me. I have to make it known to my friends and my family and the people around me. And I got to carry myself different. I'm a child of God. And then God pushed you to something different. Then I'm going to surround my business and people are going to know we do business at a Christian level. And then that got to a place where it's like, yeah, I'm not really pushing myself anymore. Everybody knows that. That's a given. And then my oldest daughter and I, we have these conversations all the time. I said, babe, what do we struggle with the most? She says, we're selfish with our time. I said, yes, we are. So it's a given that time is important to me and I'm selfish with it. And so you say I speak a lot, man, I don't do near enough. But this first priority America thing came up about a year and a half ago, actually in a business meeting in Midland. And it is a student-led ministry. We are nationwide. And so what we do is we go into a community. It's really neat. We go into a community, we'll raise some funds, and the funds are very conservative in consideration of how many lives we touch. And we have a team. We have this basically implant team that comes in and they put these functions together and they raise some money enough to get this thing launched. And then we will get with local youth pastors. It's non-denominational. We're all Jesus. And, you know, I've had a mentor of mine tell me, I get picky on some stuff scriptural wise sometimes, and he'll say, Kevin, don't fight our side. Fight the other side, man. Like, don't, you know, we're not all going to agree. You know how gray scripture can be in some, you know, some really distinct areas sometimes. And so we went non-denominational with this, and the youth pastors come around it and we get them involved, and all of a sudden they say, wait, one of my kids just got saved. And it inspires them. And then all of a sudden and then what we end up doing is we end up sliding out, and the students and the local body, you know, they're the ones that actually adopt this thing. And so we look up, and I think there was 32,000 kids meeting on in schools before COVID hit. And even during COVID, they were doing Zoom calls, and there was 15,700 or something still meeting over Zoom calls.
Wow. I mean, so you guys essentially will go in, rally them up, organize them up, get them going, and then slot out. I mean, that's leadership too at its finest as far as that's concerned. I mean, you're not even touching in their meeting and just getting changed.
Exactly. And we love Young Life and we love FCA. Of course, we're all on the same team. I sat on the FCA board for a while. And one thing I recognized was, because it's through the coaches to the players. Well, my whole family's coaches and teachers, and we all, my parents all did FCA. My brother-in-law does it. And I mean, these guys signed up for a career and they probably get paid about $4.50 an hour if you really want to add it up, you know, and then you're going to slide something else on top of them. And then they're saying, man, I really don't have time for that. So it gets bottlenecked in some areas. When it's good, it's fantastic, but it can get bottlenecked where this one is strictly up to the kiddos and to the local youth pastors and to the local businessmen. And they get to come and share as well. And we've actually seen administration do some things that you just don't even believe. They let us have access that you, I mean, there's some place in Tennessee where every administrator said, here's your badges, do whatever you want. I need Jesus on this campus.
Amen.
It's awesome. Yeah,
man. That's so good to hear. I appreciate you sharing that because, like, you know, you just turn on the news, you don't get to hear the cool stuff like that that's happening. I mean, there's a lot of movement.
Yep.
God's moving even in the schools and through schools and all over. So that's just exciting. How does a listener, if they wanted to support and help for First Priority, how do we connect with that?
Well, you can go online to First Priority of America. We're going to get some, we're just now revamping some new creative ideas where we have some text launching. And we also have testimonials. Like, I can go in there and you can follow me like on Instagram, and then it'll kick you over to our page. That's all getting kind of revamped, ready for, okay. We feel like God's, you know, there's an awakening about to happen, right? Yeah. I mean, the pendulum always swings a little too far one direction or the other. And we've almost got to be patient enough to let it get too far and be ready to capture those people when they come back, when they're all brokenhearted. And so we spent a lot of money and a lot of time and effort getting ready for a big push when we feel like schools are wide open across the United States.
That's great. And we can just get online, find you on, then support, people can support in some way. And maybe are revamping that to even to make it a little easier, but.
We are. Yeah. And then, you know, so what we can do is you and I can get creative where we can bring this, you know, maybe we can tag it on here somehow or do something unique to where you know, it's easier to find. But one of the really cool things is we're actually launching Fort Worth coming into this next year. So
absolutely.
We're doing an East Tennessee movement and then Kansas City, and then Fort Worth is, and they're already launched. We're starting in July here in Fort Worth, and I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be, I mean, we all know the type of people that we're lucky enough to be around every day. There's a church on every corner and really good business leaders. And so I've already got some people that are ready to get behind it. And I think it's going to be amazing.
Right. Yeah. We'll be able to link up in show notes, and then we can kind of talk and we'll circulate. However, even if there's help you need volunteer wise, so that's great. Cool.
That'd be awesome.
So, man, I hate to even start winding this, landing this plane, but we need to tell me a little bit about hunting and fishing. I know that's a part of your journey and something that you really enjoy. Do you have a favorite thing to hunt and a favorite thing to fish?
Yeah. So I would say of all the hunting that I've done, and I'm hardcore. I'm not, you know, the guy that goes belly crawls for 7 hours, you know, nothing like that. But I pretty much strictly bow hunt now. I've gotten to where I'm going to say elk hunting by yourself. I was able to, like, literally say, watch a YouTube video, got on this place out in New Mexico, and there was nobody there. And I spent 7 days by myself and figured out how to kill some giant. I killed two giants in back-to-back years with my bows. Yeah, with my bow.
Now, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be mad and happy to hear that at the same time.
And it's just a rancher. I mean, it was impossible to find. It was an incredible experience. Now I just would rather, I find myself letting the 5-year-old big buck pass and shooting the cold buck, you know, and just trying to do more and more. And of course, my kids are involved. My 9-year-old daughter shot 185-inch deer last year.
That's great.
Low fence. Yeah. And, she's so lucky. And then we have a little coastal house. We do a lot of coastal fishing, and then her and I, she's my outdoors one for sure. We actually won our first fishing tournament together last 2 weekends ago.
That's just great. And tell her congrats. Now tell me your daughter's names real quick.
The oldest one is Cameron. She's 11. And then now my second one is now 10. She's Atley, A-T-L-E-Y. Mm-hmm. And then I've got an 8-year-old named Sailor, and my youngest one is named Parker.
That's great. What a blessing. I mean, and just family life, it seems like the Lord really just reshaped your priorities and you're just all in. I mean, you're taking them hunting already, fishing, winning tournaments. I mean, it's fun to see that on the outside, but what's the experience like raising 4 girls? I don't know.
Well,
you have a sister, so.
It was easier about a year ago. We're getting into that transition of life. I'm sure everybody knows what I'm talking about. And I mean, my girls are very disciplined, and they know that, you know, not to buck the system. And some of that stuff's going out the door right now. But it's great for me, man. It teaches me patience, and we're open books here. So we talk about it. And of course, a girl doesn't want to talk about some of those things, you know, and I make them come home and tell me, hey, who's your first crush? You know? And they're like, no way, Dad, come on. And I'm like, yep,
that's great.
I want you to tell me. I mean, this is okay. You got to know that you can talk to Dad if Mom's not here for you, you know? So, and we tell them about our stories when me and Mom met each other, and we just don't want them to feel like they're the only ones going through what they're going through. And we have some rules here. Of course, they don't have phones. When we built this house, we built 2 bedrooms. All 4 of the girls sleep in the same room every night. I don't want anybody shutting the door. And so we try to be very proactive about what they're facing these days, you know, and push them to the outdoors. We have a swing. One of my daughters, she gets upset. She gets real upset. And we have a swing. And we said, hey, that's your swing.
Yeah.
You go out there and nobody will mess with you when you're on that swing, you know? So, but it all sounds glorious, but man, it's tough. And we have fights and my wife, I unfortunately sometimes find myself being a better father than I am a husband. And so that's one thing I'm trying to work on, you know, but the girls get to see us working through real life issues. And I think that's probably the one thing that we're getting right is just being open and honest with each other.
That's one of the biggest deals. I think the Lord's impressed upon me when we have a group of kids ourselves. It's just like, hey, you tell the kids like, man, like I need Jesus as much as you do. I'm never saying that I'm like, man, I blew it. I messed up and I'm sorry.
Right.
And we are doing it.
Well, I think some of that, I mean, at least in my experience when I was a kid, the thought was that you don't ever see your parents fight. Like they'd run all up into the back bedroom and you could hear them screaming and stuff, but they weren't going to fight in front of you. Whereas opposed to how, like, you know, we don't like getting screaming matches or whatever, but they've seen us heated against each other. And then they've also seen us calm down with each other and talk it out. Like, hey man, that's what you're supposed to do when you get mad with somebody. Tell them why you're mad and then figure it out.
And ask for forgiveness. And
yeah,
I had a cool moment. I had a biggest, meanest NFL guy you've ever seen in your life. He came down this summer and we actually all got COVID together when he was here. So he stayed for 2 weeks. We quarantined on the ranch together. And one day, and he's got a bunch of boys and I got a bunch of girls and he's tough on them. And he can't believe the way that I treat my girls because I'm tough on them. And my oldest one, I got onto her one day and jumped on her a little too hard. And he's 6'8", 280, you know, and he like grabs me by the back of the car. He's like, hey, don't talk to her that way. And I was like, well, did you just hear me talk to your son? Don't you? And we're like, let's go apologize to him. And I was like, that's exactly what we should do. So he looks, turns around and mine was rough enough and I embarrassed her enough because obviously there's other people around. I got on my knees in front of her and I apologized to her and I grabbed her by both hands and I apologized to her, man. And my buddy starts crying, you know, and he's like, dude, you know how lucky you are, Cameron, to have a dad that will just do what he just did. My dad would never have done that to me, you know? Yeah. And so those are fun experiences that you look back on, you know, it's going to imprint them as a kiddo.
Absolutely. And that's changing their lives.
Yeah.
Well, last thing, do you think you have a life kind of message that's been formulating over these years? Like, I mean, just what's your message? And I'm not sure. I mean, that's a, you know, bit of a surprise for you question. That's a little deeper, but I mean, is anything firing off that's just like, man, this is kind of my message in life?
Yeah, my message in life has got to be, and I don't know that I can articulate it correctly. One night I wrote a poem, and this poem just speaks it to me. Like, all us men are looking for, we're all warriors somewhere deep down inside. God made us a warrior, you know? And one thing I missed about the NFL was not the camaraderie, not the battles and all this kind of stuff, physical battle. I miss all that stuff. I miss the fact that I was hurting when I got up the next morning for some reason. That's meathead, but that's what I like. And, but I missed there was a scoreboard. I knew when I was winning and I knew when I was losing. And sometimes I think financially in this world, we go, well, that's my scoreboard. And I get caught up into it every day. You know, when we do a deal and everybody sees how much you sold it for, or what, you know, how much you made, or you know, how much land you got or what you're driving around in, that tends to be our scoreboard. And, you know, I've been battling with this, not that I don't know who I am or where I'm going. But this warrior mentality is like, I want to fight the battle. And yeah, I know it's spiritual, but man, that's hard to recognize where those spiritual battles are. Does that mean I'm supposed to drop everything and go to Costa Rica and go save, you know, no, God's not calling me to do that. But I think I like to encourage men that that little bit of that wonder, you know, of man, where's my next fight? I think we all go through that, and it's not, we're not going to get it perfect because we're sinful and we're on earth, you know, we're on the devil's playground out here, you know, and we're never going to find that perfect battle that God had in store for us. And so don't let it take you to a place of emptiness. Understand that there are some battles out there. You got to look for them. You got to search for them, but they're not crystal clear, and they dang sure can't be from, you know, from the world, that, which is where a lot of us go whenever we feel that emptiness and that desire to want to have that.
Man, that is so good. I appreciate you sharing that. That's so good. Well, unfortunately, we have to stop it. I can keep going. I do have, we may have to bring you back on later. I got, you know,
sure.
The questions just keep coming, but man, I appreciate you making time, Kevin, like, and really being open and honest and authentic about just family life, NFL, all that. That's a big deal. And that is a role model in a big way. So I'm just grateful.
Well, thank you. I've made a lot of screw ups, and I'm still screwing up every day, and I'll do it again in the future, but I guess we can at least share our battle scars with each other.
Absolutely. Well, man, thank you so much. And we'll look forward to connecting some First Priority of America information and see how people can help. And we'll go from there. So thanks, Kevin.
Okay, guys. We'll see you.
Hey, this is Micah. Me and Josh would like to thank you for joining us in the Story Field today. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion, and to learn more about us and The Story Field, visit thestoryfield.com. This podcast is sponsored by The Allen Firm, legal guides for many of life's situations. To learn more about The Allen Firm, visit allenlawfirm.com. Have a blessed day, week, and year, and we will see you next time on The Story Field.
This is Josh again. I just wanted to thank you for listening and let you know that this podcast is really about hope and about giving you hope for your life. So if you're listening and you're in a place where you're really feeling hopeless right now, or if you do not know Jesus, we have some great news to share with you and would love a chance to pray for you. Email us at hope@allenlawfirm.com. That's hope@allenlawfirm.com, and we'll reach out to you soon. Thank you for listening. God bless you.